Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety. Welcome to episode 2 of the 3-part George Minkoff series, the story of a B-17 bomb ordnance officer stationed in Great Ashfield, England as part of the 385th Bomb Group during World War II. In episode 1, we met George Minkoff as he entered military service and trained as an ordnance officer literally all over the U.S. We also met his son, David Minkoff, who is our guest co-host for the series. We rejoin his story now as he has arrived in England and is stationed at Great Ashfield, England, as part of the 550th Bomb Squadron of the 385th Bomb Group of the Mighty 8th Air Force. All right, so we're going to get into really the meat of George's story, which is the role he had in England, which was loading the bombs on the B-17s for the 8th Air Force.
In a little barracks, and we just had a small barracks just for 30 or 35 men in ordnance. And about 2 o'clock, the chief of the squadron would come down, wake up the chief, ordnance chief, and he would go around and wake up the crews it may be 2 a.m. And we'd go sleepy-eyed out to the place where our ordnance tent was. It was in a tent, and it had its coal stove in the middle of it, coffee and all. That's where I learned to drink coffee. Hmm. And we'd wait around there sometime 2 hours
and play blackjack.
4 o'clock, and finally. Bomb, see that you're on alert then. That's when they take you out, when you're first on alert. And then a little bit later, the bomb load would come back, maybe 500 pounds, 500 pounds, bombs and certain fuse went with it. And that would come down from London, where they were preparing for this raid on us, Schweinfurt or wherever, over in Germany. Of course, it started out bombing places in Paris. Mm-hmm. I mean, in France, not in Paris especially. Around along the road there, the submarines were might have been around in there.
Submarine pens will have.
What you call that? Submarine den or whatever you call it.
I don't know. The pens.
Base, maybe. Yeah, submarine base. And then started hitting air bases, bombing those. And then later it would be bombing into Germany, Berlin. Schweinfurt's where they got those ball bearings. Mm-hmm. And that was a tough mission. We had 548, 549th, 550th, that was my squadron, and 551st. Four squadrons on every base that I know of. All had four. And I think one time the 549th sent out there 15 planes. What it was they sent out that time, and zero came back. But right at the first of the war, it was terrible. They shot, I guess sometimes they just zone in on a certain group, and on that day they sure did, and I don't remember which mission it was, but not a single one came back. Maybe some of them might have stopped at another base and shot up too bad to go any farther. Mm. Or some may have been picked up on air sea rescue in the North Sea or something. And that got cold. Mm. It started getting winter time. You would live very long in the frigid water. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, so, he's got recollections of this, the early air war here, and we've talked before about, whenever we linked up with the British and began the bombing campaigns in Germany and everything, the British took the nighttime raids and we took the daytime raids because, and we did it without fighter escorts early on. And that led to ridiculously high losses, you know, and that's what he talked about here, how they'd have a whole group go out and zero would return.
And that is what happened more commonly at this point in the war. Most of the interviews that we've conducted, you know, Ryan and I, from the 8th Army Air Force, were from the big surge, is what Ryan and I call it, this wave that was drafted and conscripted in, say, 1942, took a year or two to train and get deployed, and then came over in this huge wave to help really overcome and annihilate what was left of Nazi Germany. Those men who talk about their experience always talk in reverence about those guys that were there before them.
Sure.
Every single one of them said, yeah, we had this. I can't tell how many times we heard this, Ryan, where someone will say, yeah, but man, you should have seen those guys in 1943. I mean, they really had it rough.
Right.
And he just gave an example of a whole squadron going up and none of them coming back. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened.
Well, the 385th actually lost more planes, I think, just about any bomb group in the whole war. That's probably why they actually have a museum in Luxembourg.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to get to that when he tells the story of Pearl Luxembourg, of the collision of the plane, the destruction of the planes and stuff. And but yeah, have you ever been over there at all? Have you seen it? Or
when Dad and I and my nephew went when they opened it.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
And then my nephew went back a couple of years later, maybe, by himself, and he said, you know, I noticed when we were here before that all the pictures up were a lot of the flight crews.
Yeah.
He goes, you need some pictures of some of the ground ordnance guys.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So the unsung heroes.
Dad's picture is up in the museum.
And let me expand just really quick on the ground crews. And I know, Ryan, you probably got some things you want to add to this. But so my dad was a weapons specialist in Vietnam, served on carriers. He was basically a ground crew, but on an aircraft carrier. He would talk about the relationship that he would develop with the pilots, with the crews, because he lowered ordnance on them. It was his job, as it would have been your dad's, I imagine, before they flew off. There would have been some element of what he did to let the pilots know, hey, this is what we have loaded on here. This is what the mission calls for. That would have been his job. And then his planes wouldn't come back. They would get shot down over Vietnam by surface-to-air missiles. Imagine what your father would have experienced where it was like that, but on a much larger scale with much higher losses. Like, I mean, that did he ever talk about people that he got to knew who were some of the flyers that didn't make it back and how it affected him?
You know, we never, you know, not really.
Yeah.
I guess that's probably something he didn't want to talk about too much.
Fair, yeah.
You know, we mentioned on the video, or not the video, the audio a while ago about Schweinfurt.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it was a ball bearing factory there. But we actually have a picture with a painting actually done. I guess somebody took a picture during the raid at Schweinfurt from, you know, they had cameras going all the time probably on the bombers and stuff. Anyway, and it's done. This painting I have is done from some picture they got. I mean, they're getting swarmed by German fighters and stuff, right? And but on the tail of all the planes, you can see the square G.
Which really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that the 385th?
385th.
Yeah.
It was a square G. Huh. And so that was pretty cool. But I was telling people at church one day about that, going to Schweinfurt. And one of the members in the class goes, oh, the ball bearing factory. He knew He knew what was there, and I had no clue.
Yeah.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, and there's a great book that was recently published by Malcolm Gladwell called The Bomber Mafia. And it's about this idea of this high-altitude precision bombing that the United States was trying to accomplish during World War II. And quite frankly, during World War II, largely failed. It wouldn't be until the 70s and 80s where their vision of one bomb, one kill, one bomb, one bridge, one bomb, one brigade would actually take place with the precision munitions we have now. But the Schweinfurt raid, the ball bearings, came from what happened to the United States in the late 1930s. There was a company, I think it was in Illinois and Chicago, that made propellers.
Okay.
And these propellers were variable speed, and they required a special type of ball bearing. The ball bearings for this particular propeller, which was widely used, the plant burned down in the United States. and it crippled production of propellers. And for about a year, there was a shortage of propellers where, as we were, when the war started, when we were ferrying, like, the WASPs, the women, auxiliary, whatever corps, the female pilots that would ferry these planes around, they would actually take off their propeller, put it on another plane that didn't have a propeller, and then fly it. And they had to do that for a year, year and a half. And so the one of the origins for this idea of going after things like these ball bearing plants came from our experience in the United States right before the war started, where we were crippled because one plant was destroyed in a fire that provided ball bearings. So this is why they started going after things like ball bearing plants and synthetic oil and some of the other things we talked about in previous podcasts.
The crucial parts of the infrastructure of the plane.
You don't need to bomb everything. You just need to bomb the thing that cripples everything.
Right. It's kind of like the idea of, with respect, instead of banning guns, let's just ban the bullets.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Because then the guns don't work. You know, it's the same thing with the parts for the planes.
Totally. So it's interesting. You talked about Schweinfurt. I've had a chance to read more on that lately. And it had to do with what happened in the United States and our experiences there prior to the war.
So after the bomb, then when we finally got, we drank coffee until then. And when finally we get the bomb loaded, we go out and get the number of bombs it took. And usually had a crew of four would have probably two planes to load. So we had a lot of crews. And so two of them, like I said, would be working at the bottom when we were loading them, and two would be up to Bombay. One at the tail and one at the head. And so they could rock that shackle up and hook that shackle on. Just a little thing about like that. Mm-hmm. That had could snap into the Bombay rack, and the bottom held on to the bombs, and that opened up at the same time, and let the bombs fall. And then when we started doing our, all that time, we'd be loading up our bomb revetment with bombs, 500 pounds, 1,000 pounds, sometimes 2,000 pounds, and then we'd have to set them up neatly in a revetment. Stack them up maybe too high, sometimes smaller bombs, maybe three, with dunnage in between 4x4s, in between them, just set them on there. And then actually, we got very good at loading our bombs on there because we just put another couple down to our trailer and just sort of roll them down on that dunnage and on the trailer, push them way up. And so we found an easy way to do those. And or sometime on a lower one, you had to go up slightly. We just roll them up the dunnage, not carry them. We had a couple of carrying bars, but that's work. It worked anyway.
So what were the smallest bombs? I know you said up to 2,000 pounds. What were the smallest ones?
Oh, I got 2,000, 1,000, and 500, 300, and 100.
And did the B-17 carry all of those?
Oh, not the same time. Carry them all. Maybe 10. Each would have maybe 10 or 12 500-pound bombs.
What was the purpose of having a 100-pound bomb? What sort of target would a 100-pound
really
bomb
know.
Be
that
for?
Would be
versus at
that? They decided in London, I guess. They had a lot of different kind of bombs than that. Mm-hmm. They had fire bombs, and they had incendiary bombs, and fragmentation bombs that they would be set to detonate above ground, so we could get any people that's on the ground, you know, around that area. It may be 100 feet, and they can do that with a barometer. I'm sure that's what they used, but I'm not sure. But and then they had armor-piercing bombs that would go through metal, steel, and what other kind? Fragmentation. I'll tell you that. Yeah, I said that already. Little bombs would go up there too. Had little cluster bombs. That's what I'm trying to think. Mm-hmm. And it'd be a lot of them in wired together like this, and something would detonate and as they were going down, and then there should be little small ones. Now, they're usually fire bombs that would be floating down all around the place. And the one that, the fire bombs one, we had to load it. I mean, it was time consuming, and here it is at nighttime, and you're loading the bomb by pumping the flammable stuff, I forget what it was now, into the bombs, and then you load the bombs on the...
Was that napalm?
Napalm, yeah, napalm. And loading them, and then we had to load those on the plane, and then after we got the bombs loaded, all kinds, those kinds, and demolition bombs like those 300, 100, 500 pounders, you'd have to screw after they were loaded.
So I'm just going to jump in here because he continues on with the process. But, you know, a lot of times when we interview our veterans, we're blessed with them providing us a manuscript that they've written earlier in their life of their recollections. And they've sat down and, you know, maybe when they had, you know, better memories or better recall. And George is no exception. He provided me a copy of, you know, about a three, four-page document called Aviation Ordnance from World War II. And I want to read from some of it. And then I've got some statistics on, you know, some information on all the bombs that the B-17 would carry and the purpose behind them and their origins and stuff. But for part of his manuscript here, he says there's many types of ordnance in the Army, Air Force, and the Navy of the United States. The infantry would have, among other things, the half-tracks, the jeeps, the tanks, trucks, personnel carriers, and hundreds of other items, including tents of all sizes. The 385th Bomb Group would also have transportation ordnance, including fire trucks, ordnance trucks, but by and large, this version of aviation ordnance only pertains to arming our B-17s. This would be the bombs from 100-pounders all the way up to 2,000-pound bombs, the 50-caliber machine guns, the 20-millimeter cannons, fuses, bomb sights, and hand-on-shoulder weapons. Crews were issued 45-caliber Colt pistols, but an order came down from Colonel Vandeventer that no weapons would be carried on the mission as the Germans were shooting downed airmen on the spot if they were armed.
We've heard that in other interviews we've conducted relatively recently,
yep,
where some men violated that order. They wanted to have something on them, but the standing order was to be unarmed. So if you were taken prisoner, there could be no excuse for being shot as an armed combatant.
I think it was Harold Dunn that we interviewed whenever he landed, when he had his sidearm on him.
Yes.
And he's like, I don't want to be on the ground without a gun. But then he realized when he was on the ground, crap, yeah, I don't want this thing because they're going to shoot me.
Basically, he was like, okay, now that I'm here, I got this gun. It's pretty worthless.
Right. Yeah, what am I going to do?
What I'm faced up against, yes. But yeah, that was a standing order.
So he says, so the Ordnance Department of the 385th and all other bomb groups in the ETO took care of the ordnance assigned to them and used this ordnance to arm their B-17s, B-24s, or whatever armament was used on the particular planes. Of course, different planes were used in different theaters of war as the requirements and terrain were different. To begin with, when the 385th Bomb Group was put on alert, the four ordnance departments would be called out to the line, probably about 2 to 3 a.m., as he just described to us here, to await the bomb load from the wing. Of course, the missions, including the armament, was carefully thought out at the 8th Air Force headquarters in London before being sent down to the 3rd Air Division, the wing, and then to the bomb groups over East Anglia. Sometimes the wait is long and a lot of strong coffee is consumed, but it finally comes 12 500-pound bombs with contact fuses per plane and given the time of takeoff. An ordnance crew of four would be assigned a bomb truck, a bomb trailer, drive to the revetment, and load enough bombs for their first plane. Two ordnance men would work on the ground, putting on tail fins, shackles with the arming wires, the slings around the bombs, and preparing them for hoisting. When the bombs had been cranked to the proper height by the armament crew, the other two ordnance men who were positioned in the bomb bay would attach the shackle to the bomb rack, starting at the top. This is repeated until all bombs were loaded in both sides of the bomb bay. When loading was finished, another crew would later return to the planes and screw in the nose and tail fuses, making sure that the arming wires were through each fuse. This was very important so that the arming vane would not unscrew, rendering the bomb armed while in flight. One last sentence here. When they had finished their first plane, the loading crews would return to the ordnance tent and be assigned another B-17. Two planes was about par for a crew for the day.
So does he speak or elaborate more either on the audio or in this document about the two fuses? I knew there was a nose fuse. I didn't know there was a tail fuse.
He does talk about that a bit here.
Okay, cool. So we're going to hear more about that.
Yeah. So what we'll do, I just kind of wanted to make sure I include manuscripts in what we do if we've got them, because that's just another resource that validates and backs up and a lot of times provides new information that was not in the interview.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, we have a website. We've had one now for almost a year. Every veteran we feature has their own web page, and we will include, like we have in the past, any sort of manuscripts, any sort of photos, any additional information on there. So when this particular series drops and you go to the website, you'll be able to access this manuscript and read it for yourself.
So as luck would have it, our next clip is about tail and nose fuse installation.
All right, let's do it. All right, cool.
After they were all actually loaded on the bomb racks, was another crew come to the plane and screw in a tail fin and a nose. I mean, a tail fuse I'm talking about, and a nose fuse. And on every bomb. If one of them didn't fail, the other would. So when you're loading the bombs, we'd have a couple of guys at the bottom that roll them on the thing on until they rolled them back to the back. We'd be, me and another guy would say, would be the ones that are going to put them on. We'd be up, feet across like this, wide apart to get balance, and in front of us, the armament men were up there too at the same time. And they were cranking up the bombs. So they cranked them up, and they were lengthwise with a plane. And as soon as they got up and made a shackle on the bombs right then. And so when he got up there, we'd hook this one on a bomb rack, and then that's where I do a little lifting, and this one on the other side. And we'd load it from top to bottom. And then the next one, they'd roll back, and well, they'd roll them back, and that's when they'd fin them, put a tail fin on before we got them. So, so every time we got one, they'd have the tail fin, not the fuse. The fuse put in later, had the tail fin on. And we'd go up and we'd hook that one up there, and we could do that pretty good.
Were they pretty safe without the fuses in them to handle?
Oh, yeah, they didn't load anything fuse until you got it completely up in there. And then they fused them. Hmm. They wouldn't fuse them before that.
What were the bombs? What was the explosive in the bombs? Was it gunpowder or was it?
What'd you say?
What was the explosive?
I can't remember. It wasn't liquid though. Just gunpowder stuff, I think. Mm. I used to know. I know the primers have tetrol in them. Mm. I remember that. Primers on any on the 50 caliber machine gun weapon on the bullets. Call them buff now. Rounds. Mm-hmm. They call them rounds. And the little tetra that the firing pit hits was had tetrol in the primers. That's coming back to me.
Okay.
The primers. And so I said, I was going to tell you, that was about the loading. Just until you get them all done.
So I had asked him the question about, you know, what is actually in what's the explosive in the bombs? Because each of the bombs actually had a different type of explosive. And what I want to talk about a bit now is some information on the individual bombs, you know, and the purpose for them. And, you know, a lot of times they'll give us, you know, what sort of explosive was in it. So, you know, he mentions the M30, 100 pound bomb, the M31, 300 pound bomb, the M43, 500 pound, the M44, 1,000 pound, and the M34, 2,000 pound. I don't know why they name them the numbering that way, because it's kind of counterintuitive. The 500,000 and 2,000 pound bombs were carried for industrial targets and for the other airfields, like when they would bomb airfields. The 8th Air Force used 1,000 and 2,000 pound bombs for attacks on submarine pens, but these had little effect because of the vast concrete fortifications, the very thick, 10-foot-thick concrete roofs that they had that sheltered the U-boats from most of the damage that was done in the surrounding port area. This was around Le Havre. And
I still would not have wanted to been a German in those pens while these bombs were landing on them. Yes, they were safe, but holy crap, that must have been a frightening experience.
So this was something I didn't realize. I mean, I know they had these bunker buster bombs that they had back then. They're called Grand Slams, you know, but there was also one called the Disney Rocket Bomb.
What is that?
Which I was like, why do they name it Disney? And it's for Walt Disney.
What?
Apparently, this was an idea that they got from one of the Walt Disney cartoons that were used in the propaganda training. You know, the Disney Studios was basically taken over by the government and said, you're going to work for us during the war.
Yeah.
So that's what they did, and I'd love to see what cartoon they got this idea from. It says it's a 4,500-pound bomb that was designed for penetrating the thick concrete of the U-boat shelters. It was a free fall until a rocket motor fired at 5,000 feet, pushing the missile to speeds of 2,400 feet per second upon impact.
Yeah, I'm with you. I would have loved to have seen that. Okay, so what cartoon were we showing people that led to us developing this rocket-assisted free-falling gravity bomb?
It could penetrate 20 feet of solid concrete before it exploded.
So those U-boat pens ultimately were cracked. They ultimately, many of those actually did get hit. It was later in the war, I think 45, and were destroyed. Maybe it's 44, actually. I wonder if it was those bombs that did it.
Well, it says here that they were first used by the 92nd Bomb Group on March the 14th of 45, so very late in the war.
Yes.
Still, that's a big punch there. And that's, you know, and we've heard about a lot of this, you know, our bunker buster bombs during the Gulf Wars. I thought that was all relatively new technology. But, you know, there's a lot of technology that we're seeing nowadays that was developed in World War II.
So in Vietnam, my dad said most of the bombs and ordnance that they loaded on the A4 Skyhawks had dates from 1944 and 45 on them.
This
was 1967.
Really?
So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a whole lot of new research and development into the ordnance
most
between
of the bombs
that 20
that were
years
dropped in Vietnam. Here you are in the 60s. The bomber mafia wanted this one hit, one shot, one kill sort of thing. And for most of the Vietnam War, they were just dumb gravity bombs, oftentimes pulled out of storage from World War II.
Well, look, you know, you got a bunch of old ammo, might as well burn it up, right?
and you didn't have anything better.
Right.
It was still like state of the art back then. And it wasn't until the end of the Vietnam era where we started testing with, you know, TV camera type guided bombs and stuff to take out specific bridges. And it really wouldn't be until the Gulf War in, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, where these weapons were actually used and shown to be effective. So these ideas that these individuals had, these planners had, way back in the 30s, it took 50 years for it to come in fruition. And up until that happened, it was just this stuff. I don't know, what's in a standard general purpose bomb? What type of explosive is that?
So a little bit more on that here. So the general purpose bombs were used in early missions, were fitted with quarter second delay tail fuses with an extra tenth of a second fuse in the nose. Huh. In a report that in December of 42, after the raid on Lille, France, it was calculated that 30% of the bombs dropped had failed to explode because the arming mechanisms had frozen up after being exposed to the damp conditions on the airfields, like at Great Ash Field.
What a terrible place to prosecute a war.
Because of them sitting overnight.
Right.
Standard operating procedure was soon challenged, so that the fuses were installed just before takeoff.
And that's okay? What he had to do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Eventually, to avoid accidents in landing, the fuses were to be inserted only when the bombs were securely fixed to the aircraft. In 1943, a new set of general-purpose bombs were produced. There were 250, 500, 1,000, and 2,000-pound bombs. These accounted for most of the bombs dropped in the final year of the war. In January of 1945, experts recommended 250-pound general-purpose bombs to be used against synthetic oil plants, ammunition dumps, and storage facilities. The 100-pound bomb was recommended for attacking railway yards and runways.
Yep, yeah.
So some of the bombs that they used, and this is where we're getting into some of the explosive in this, the incendiary bombs. Originally, the only incendiary bomb were available were the British 250 and 500-pound models that were filled with a rubber gasoline mix. But in November of 42, the M50A 41-pound magnesium bomb was added to the arsenal. It was packed in 100-pound clusters, which had a tendency to open prematurely, disperse too widely, and cause damage to other planes in the formation. Oh, my gosh.
Having magnesium landed on your aluminum wing?
Oh, yeah. You don't want that.
It's not going to last long.
In January 44, the USA Air Force used the 500 M17 cluster, which had a better ballistics and a primacord release that could be set to give correct disbursement of the bombs. This became the most favored and effective incendiary bomb among the bomber groups. High explosive and incendiary bombs fell through the air in varying trajectories, and thus an accurate attack with a mixed load was very difficult to aim. Yep. For this reason, time lag tables were used to indicate the release interval times of the different types of bombs. Eventually, factors such as wind speed and altitude were also taken into account. Hmm. For napalm bombs, in the latter half of 44, a refined petroleum jelly called napalm, which we
talked about in the Ira Bewley episode, and that's also in the Bomber Mafia book that was published a few years ago.
And that's where they developed that at, was it Harvard?
It was at Harvard, and the football field is where it was tested by some mad scientist. And it would become widely deployed, as I mentioned, and from 1944 on.
Yep. It's known as the Class C firebomb with a capacity of 108 U.S. gallons.
Which what George mentions, he hated loading those because they had to go on the flight line and pump them while they were on. I thought they pumped them full of napalm and then loaded them. But no, they had to do it when they were in the bomb bay.
I wonder, I guess because the weight.
Weight, safety, I don't know
I bet you it was weight more than anything else.
Yeah, they didn't really care much about safety.
Yeah.
I mean, opening clip talked about how they got rid of a bomb that was stuck in the shackles.
Just
so
kick it.
Kick it while you're straddling it. Wait, we'll get to that one later, but at any rate.
So these bombs were only used on a few missions. A B-17 carried four such bombs with tiny igniter units fitted to each tank. Fragmentation bombs, used as anti-personnel bombs during the ground force support attacks, these 20-pound M41s were fitted in 120 and 500-pound clusters. They were very light bombs, and the B-17 Norden bomb site had to be used with a special computation table to provide the maximum trail angle or distance between the plane and the point of impact. You know, a lot of times you'll see, photos of the bombers dropping their bombs, and there'll be one of them that has a little smoke trail coming from it, and that's so that the bombers, the bombardiers, and the navigators can actually see their bombs go all the way down to the ground.
I didn't know that. So it was a tracer, basically.
It's a tracer, so you can actually watch the trail and see where it goes. Because, how many times if you're getting attacked, do you keep your eye on the bombs the whole way down?
Well,
Probably not.
When these bombs are falling, you just can't see them when you're that high up in the air. So it makes sense to put something that would allow you to trace the trajectory.
Yeah. Huh. Let's see here. Poison gas bombs were kept in stock as a deterrent throughout the war by the 8th Air Force that consisted of two types, both made in Britain. The 400-pound flying cow mustard gas bomb and the 500-pound phosgene bomb.
Yeah.
So luckily those were never used.
Yeah, it sounds terrible. I mean, it's all terrible, but that's like terrible squared.
Yeah.
gas.
Oh, man. The VB-1 Azon bomb, that's A-Z-O-N. It's a basic 1,000-pound bomb, but with a special tail attachment, which allowed it to be steered over a distance of 200 feet to either side of the point of impact from a height of 20,000 feet.
Huh.
They were controlled by the dropping aircraft using a ANARW-9 transmitter. The bomb could only be attached to a B-24 on a 2,000-pound bomb shackle.
Wow, so a radio-controlled bomb.
Yeah. First kind of smart bomb, really.
In Dorothy Gibbons' episode, we talk about the development of drones where you took aircraft and put TV cameras on them, and another plane would steer a bomb-laden bomber-type plane into targets. That was the kind of origin of the drones that we see today. And here we are talking about kind of a really primitive form of a radio-controlled bomb.
So here's a bit more on the evolution of the drone program here. So the GB-1 glide bomb.
Oh.
This was made from the M-34 2,000-pound bomb fixed to a 12-foot span glider and attached to a B-17 underwing shackle.
Wait a minute. You need to stop and think about this. First off, the B-17 is a big bomber, right? And then you had these glide bombs with 12-foot wingspans.
Yeah.
That's wide. Underneath the wings.
I mean, probably one under each wing.
Exactly. So here you are. You got this bomber flying through the air with these two little mini bombers underneath it. It must have been a sight to behold.
Yeah, it says two glide bombs could be carried per plane. Essentially, they would free fall. The bomb had a stabilizing device that allowed control of the direction. The bomb proved to be unreliable on the only occasion it was used in Cologne, Germany of April of 44. So prior to D-Day. The next in the evolution in the bombs that were carried by the B-17 is the GB-4. A radio-controlled bomb with a TV camera fitted in the nose section that transmitted a TV signal over a range of 15 miles. It was only ever used on one plane, a B-17, on a single combat sortie. So apparently it didn't work well. It was probably too cumbersome. And then we talked about the Disney rocket bomb. And then, of course, there was the different bomb sites. There was the Norden bomb site. Something else called a vector bomb site and a tachymetric site. The tachymetric site was actually was called the Norden.
Was it a tachymetric?
It was
tachymetric.
Tachymetric.
It'd be cool if it was like a tachymetric.
No, a tachymetric.
It's a tachymetric with the at any rate.
So cool. Anyway, I just a little diversion there, but I wanted to make sure we talked about the individual bombs. As far as different explosives, he thought that it was mostly gunpowder that was in a lot of these, but yeah. I think there was probably a much more high explosive used.
Well, the Navy had Torpax for their torpedoes, which right. was a really high high intensity explosive. I'm not saying that it wasn't used, but I do know that there was some pretty sophisticated explosives that were available at that time in the war. And mm-hmm. quite frankly, my dad was a weapons specialist not nearly as long ago as when George was interviewed. And I'm pretty sure he can't remember what they put in those things either. That's pretty esoteric.
Yeah,
Most of these guys, what they were focused on is knowing the variety of weapons that they had to understand how to handle, load, and arm.
Yep.
And that's what he's talking about, which is really cool. We don't usually get this level of detail from veterans talking about this.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next clip here. So we just talked about the explosives. Now he's going to talk about how this other group of guys, the armors, would actually crank the bombs up into the bomb bay and everything.
And the armors would do the cranking up. And the armors also is one that set the levers and everything that you'd pull to let the bomb down. Now, sometimes you had to come back. Now, I told you had a shackle. The shackle is between the bomb and bomb rack and the bomb. And hook into the thing. All right. Now, if you normally wanted to bomb the targets, and it onto that shackle was a loop, and it hooked it in there, part of the shackle hooked that wire, and then from that came down and then went through the lugs. They get two lugs on top to the fuses. They're already on there, and the guys, when they get the fuses on, the wire sticking down like that, those fuses are made in the munition plant, and they have a little fan on the end of it, like a vane called the army vane, and when you drop that bomb down, it pulls that wire. The wire is holding that from just ordinary air coming through the bomb bay. If that wire wasn't holding it like that, it had a cotter pin to start with from the munition plant in that hole. So when you fuse it, you take that cotter pin out, throw it down, and then if you wanted to, if you just put your finger on it, that thing starts spinning. But you don't do it right then. But then you put that army vein through that hole, and then put a little clip on it that would hold that in there. Front one and a back one, nose and tail. So they had that little vein on them. It dropped from the shackle. The shackle stays with have a little lever up there in the cockpit,
mm-hmm.
and it drops them. armed, to be armed. It will be armed when, so the, when it falls out, the shackles holding that, in that little loop of the wire going down there, it pulls that out. It drops away from us, what it does, and then immediately those vanes, they call them, little pins, start turning from the air as it goes down, and they'll finally, after it goes down a ways, they'll fall off. And then those two fuses, bomb fuses, are live. As soon as they hit something, if they hit another plane, hit another plane, they both blow up.
So the vanes spinning, when they finally get... Whenever the vanes come off the bomb, then the bomb is armed. It's already halfway down to the ground by then.
Yeah. It's not armed while you're flying along.
Okay.
It pulled out the Carter pin, all right. They put in an ordnance plant that made them. But immediately you stuck this army vane, it's just a wire, through each side, nose and tail. And then when that bomb fell, there about dangling wires would be there.
Okay. So as soon as they exited the plane, then they were armed.
Yeah, after they go down a ways, then those little vanes keep turning until they closed off. And then they're armed.
I see.
And
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
So I just want to jump in here. This is something we've heard spoken about in a couple of previous series we've done, the Allen Senior series.
Our pilot series, our very first podcast.
Yeah, that's correct. And I want to read a little bit from George's manuscript, because he says it a bit more succinctly here in the manuscript. And he says, now, for the cotter pin thing, when the fuses were manufactured at the munitions plant, a vane, which was a small fan, was at one end of the fuse, and it was secured by a cotter pin. That made it safe, as it kept the little vane from unscrewing in transit and during the fusing phase. After the plane was airborne, the bombardier, or a knowledgeable gunner, would remove the cotter pins and the pilot would announce, "The bombs are armed." Actually, they're only armed after the bombs are dropped and the little vane spins off. When any plane brings back its bombs, then the cotter pins would have to be reinstalled. Removing cotter pins was a very difficult job for the bombardier, as he was working with gloves and at 25 degrees or more below zero. Later in the war, they used an enlisted man to be a toggleer who dropped the bombs where the lead plane dropped them.
And we have both of those experiences captured in our podcast. We have the experience pre-toggleer, with Allen Senior talking about, Allen Senior is a waste gunner.
Yep.
And,
right.
And they were like, you know, hey, the mission's been scrubbed, put the cotter pins back in. Hey, the mission's back in, take them out. And then finally, it's like, no, we're heading back. The mission's scrubbed. And by this time, the cotter pins are all bent and twisted. And,
right.
And he's got to do it. They can't land with a bunch of armed bombs.
Right.
Because then you're a landing bomb, mm-hmm. if anything could happen. And you could kill hundreds of people around you on the ground crews, other bombers. So, and then we also had the Jerry Gentis,
who I'd never heard that term before
until we interviewed him.
Yeah,
and now we know that it was basically a safety precaution.
David, was your dad friends with Jerry Gentis?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I got to tell a story real quick about Jerry
and
he was out at Riverside Airport when one of the B-17s came into town.
He was always a fixture for those B-17s. He was like their spokesperson almost.
Yeah. And he was sitting in his little lawn chair, and there was a guy to his left that he was talking to, and I was standing on the right side of his chair, and he hadn't seen me yet. And we got done talking, I said, yeah, my dad was the ground crew for this guy. And he turned and looked, hey! He knew who I was, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Boy, I really liked Jerry. He was just such a nice, gentle guy.
Did he pass away now, too? Or?
Yeah, he passed away several years ago.
Did he?
Yeah.
I always kind of wondered about him, if he was still around or not. He'd be pretty old, but...
Yeah. So did your dad get to know Gerald Gentis here in Tulsa, or did they... Did they
just
have,
from over there, I think.
From really? Over there. From so they actually brush shoulders over in England.
Oh, yeah.
That is awesome.
That is a pretty cool
and
link,
and they ended
isn't
up here
it?
And here reconnecting.
Just a few miles away from each other.
Oh, that is so crazy.
Yeah.
We had not heard of a toggleer until Ryan interviewed Gerald, and then we had to do some research on it. And now we come full circle that this explains why that particular
role was created.
Mm-hmm.
Was to prevent people from like your Allen seniors to have to plug and unplug cotter pins and stuff like that.
Well, you know, and they talked about, you know, that they were required to keep the cotter pins and they had to turn them in at the end of the mission.
Yeah.
You know, and I always wondered about that. You know, I think part of it was to prove that they actually armed the bombs and that they were dropped in case they had someone who might have been a conscientious objector or something like that. That might be, you know, I mean, I'm saying that might have been part of it. So,
yeah, I'm sure there was a number of reasons to do it. Part of it is just probably simply like an inventory thing, an accountability thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like a kind of a. I mean, here we are in 2023. We're talking about 1943 and 44, and it seems archaic because it is that you have like this mechanical cotter pin that's preventing your plane from blowing up if you crash on landing. But that's how it was back then.
Yep. This concludes episode 2 of the George Minkoff series on the Warrior Next Door podcast. Please join us for episode 3, where George tells us some of the stories of the danger of arming the bombs in flight, as well as another story about the ever-present danger of mid-air collisions.